Welcome to the Weekend Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. Graham Goodwin, how are you in the UK coming off of a busy Sunday with the Le Mans test day?
Well, busy Saturday and Sunday, MP. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are in the world, everybody. Yes, I think you can probably hear from my nasal tone, just getting over a nasty chest infection picked up on the trip over to Le Mans, but hopefully that's going to clear up before we go back again overnight on Friday. But lots going on. The grid looks great, 60 cars, and everybody got out of that relatively unscathed, with a couple of exceptions. But they will be fine for race week. Aston Martin with a bit of work ahead of them. Dragon Speed finishing the session with the 31 car in the wall, but all repairable. But yes, looking forward in that way that you do when you shudder in your boots to a very busy week next week.
And we also had Detroit IMSA last weekend, which we are going to get into in a moment. But before we do that, Graham, let's talk about some of the plans we've hatched for next week, the week of Le Mans. So we're going to do a couple things. We're going to try and kick off a model that I used last month at the Indianapolis 500, where I did a day at Indy. And effectively, the format was 10 to 15 minutes, end of day. Maybe 20, depending on who it was or how much we had to talk about. And that could be a guest driver, team owner, engineer, you name it. And just try and talk about what happened, what went on, interesting points and such. Just give folks a little bit of a short wrap-up podcast. And so we're going to try and do the same thing at Le Mans. Now, the only thing that's a little bit different that I'm not exactly loving, but it is what it is I will not be at Le Mans. So this will be the second year in a row that I've missed. Last year, I had a good reason to miss. That was being part of the Fox broadcast team calling the race, which was definitely one of the highlights of my career. Unfortunately, I will be watching, Graham, the 24 Hours of Le Mans at home for the first time since 2006. So,
wow.
Yeah, and that doesn't make me feel great, but okay. So I will be here in California. You will be in Le Mans. So what we're going to try and do, dear listeners, is some form of end of day wrap up. It could be Graham and I. I'm sure it'll be he and I a couple of times. It could be a driver. You know, we're gonna figure it out as we go here. And also, we should note that with the timing of some things, with qualifying and whatnot ending at midnight, getting a podcast spun up when everyone's just trying to get a report out the door and then run to the car park, try and get back to the hotel, get a little bit of sleep and come back and do it again. It might not necessarily be the day at, it could be the day after when folks come back in the morning. But regardless, we're going to do our best. And so hopefully, as you've maybe figured out here with our Week in Sports Car podcast, we just kind of play it by ear, and I think we're going to try and do that with the Day at Le Mans daily podcast next week, Monday through Friday. The other thing we're going to do, which is I'm quite looking forward to, thanks to Graham for this idea, is rather than cook up a normal Week in Sports Cars podcast next week, which, as you might suspect, would probably feature heavily on previewing Le Mans, we said, hey, we're going to do that, but instead of Graham and I yapping and pontificating for however long, we'll offer some initial thoughts. We'll share some whatever things that come to mind that we think might be interesting for you to look at or consider as you prepare for the race. But it's going to be 95% of a Le Mans preview driven by your questions, your thoughts, your opinions. So we're going to send out the request probably Sunday, maybe Monday, but really long story short, our week in sports cars for the 24 Hours of Le Mans is effectively going to be your show, where you tell us what you want us to talk about, you tell us what you think is going to happen, and we are taking instructions from you, dear listeners. So that's what's coming up next week. But We're not there yet. So let's talk about what just happened, Graham. Tell me more about the Le Mans test day than maybe we saw on the printed page or the result sheet told us, with Toyota obviously leading by a, you know, I mean, 0.6 of a second wasn't a giant gap to the Rebellion team, but, you know, that was quite interesting. You move down to LMP2, and it looks like some of the same qualities as seen last year with the Eureka chassis, despite the Jokers. That's playing out. GT as well, both Pro and AM. What did you see there that is kind of intriguing you at this point, beyond what you've already captured in print?
Well, LMP1, I think, could be fascinating for the first stint. After that, I think there's little doubt, unless things go awry for the Toyotas, there is going to be a gap that opens up. If the race runs unfettered for all 60 cars and everybody has no incidents whatsoever,
oh yeah,
Toyota will win the race.
Money on that.
But what we did see is what I think a number of us did actually suspect, which is at the Le Mans, around the Le Mans circuit, the non-hybrid cars, the best of them at the moment, are going to be mighty, mighty quick. The best time set by the Toyota was around 4.5 seconds off its pole time last year. But we did get twice during the sessions, the Rebellion, number three Rebellion, the youngsters car, if you like, splitting the Toyotas, Thomas Laurent in the first session and, Matthias Besch in the second session. The interesting thing for me is we didn't quite see that level of pace yet, at least from the car we expect to see real pace from, the number one car. So yes, we know that the Toyota, which is effectively more or less the same package as last year, can and almost certainly will go quicker in qualifying. We don't know yet how quick the Rebellion can go. SMP Racing, pretty quick. Bike Honest, pretty quick. In fact, quicker at the test day than they were in qualifying last year. The Ginettas, not quite where they wanted to be. Dragon Speed had an issue in the morning with their brand new chassis, newly rebuilt car after Spa. Ginettas, not yet with a low drag kit. Their recovery period continues after the financial woes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think what we're looking at here, MP, is, look, what do I think? I think a non-hybrid car could lead Le Mans on the first lap. And I think a non-hybrid car could lead Le Mans for quite some little time into the first hour. After that, I do expect things to kind of swing back the other way. But behind the Toyotas, I think we could have quite a little battle. Jenson Button in fine form and enjoying his first Le Mans adventure. Beyond that, I think the LMP1 team's getting to grips with their new machinery, and that's proven to be quite exciting. You're correct, by the way, in LMP2. Orica still, I'd say, pretty dominant. I would say, though, the better-pedalled Ligiers have found some pace. Excellent form from the number 22 United Autosports Ligier, not just in the hands of Felipe Albuquerque, you'd expect him from him, but from Philip Hansen as well. And it was he that actually got in amongst the Oricas first amongst the Ligier runners. I think in perfect conditions, the Ligiers have got something of a say around what might be the pattern coming into the first part of the race before we see the inevitable issues on and off track start to get involved in that race. GT, tale of two parts of the grid. Part number one, and we'll come on to the story in GTE in a moment. Part number one are the cars running very quickly. Ferrari somewhere in the middle, and then off the pace with the exception of the odd lap from BMW, and woefully off the pace from Aston Martin, who ended up with one car, frankly, in a bucket after a major shunt involving Marco Sorensen, who is fine, and the 95 car, which isn't. They will build up a new chassis. There will be a new number 95 back in time for scrutineering this coming weekend. Aston Martin still telling a tale that they're nowhere in terms of balance of performance. I'm not so sure that it's that simple an answer. But good stuff, by the way, in GTM. But for me, the biggest story in GT wasn't about the pace, although that was pretty mega. It was about the look, and about the look of two cars in particular, because Porsche, the little minxes that they are, sprung a surprise on us with not just a garage that was actually decked out to celebrate their 70th anniversary, but the two full season WEC cars look utterly stunning. The 91 car in full Rothmans livery, without the Rothmans, because that's not permitted anymore, and the 92 car in glorious and beautifully executed pink pig livery from the 1971 Porsche 91720. Porsche, I doff my cap. In recent years, your history of factory liveries has been not that shining. This, my friends, it's payback. Brilliantly done, brilliantly executed, great fun, and they will be massive, massive fan favorites.
Yeah, and we have a question about those liveries too, so we'll save sharing personal thoughts or deeper personal thoughts on those. I guess of the other things that stood out to me, looking at how things shook out, not surprised to see the BMW M8 GTEs, not crazy far out of the window. The fastest lap being set by the 81 entry, Martin Tomczyk, Nicky Katzberg, at a 353.9. The fastest lap being set by one of the two factory Porsches. The Porsches were 1-2 with a 352.5. So granted, again, it's still a big gap, but it's not as big as I thought it might have been. Better than, say, what BMW found on the car's introduction earlier this year at the Rolex 24 at Daytona. But I'm looking at, you know, how we have a new model that is vaguely in the window, faster than the best Ferrari, faster than both Corvettes. So while not as far off as the same model in IMSA, I'm looking at the GT side, at least, the GTE program, and wondering how Vincent Beaumanil and the rest of the ACO's technical team takes all the data and decides who gets a little more, who gets a little bit less, to try and balance the cars come race week, which, again, it's almost here. But of all the things that stood out, you know, the equivalence of technology as applied in LMP1, hybrid, non-hybrid, I mean, we're talking about, as you mentioned, the lead, the fastest overall car, the Toyota TS050, well off its qualifying pace. I don't know if we expected qualifying grade laps to be turned in during the test day. Would expect the cars to be faster for sure once we get into some of the usual crazy night running during race week. But just interesting to see that these efforts, Graham, tell me if you agree, to peel the P1 hybrid back, to assert the non-hybrids. Numerically, we're looking at a 319.0 as the best, that coming from the Toyota, number 8 Toyota. And, you know, if we go down to 6th place, the SMP Racing BR1 AER in 6th place is at a 321.7, so a 2.7 second gap to the fastest car from P1 to P6. Not as big a gap as I thought it would be. Did you think that would be the case?
I think we expected things to be different at Le Mans. It was, it has to be said, I think a pleasant surprise. It was particularly pleasant to see the Rebellions getting involved in the ding-dong for post-test day headlines. It was pretty clear that the number 3 car was sent to do exactly that. Number 1 to tease out a bit of effort from the Toyotas, but number 2 to try to do it for themselves, and that was good to see. I think the key to this is a sort of brave new world, and yes, I think an element of cynicism comes with it around the advantage that is being handed here in terms of the efficiency side of things to Toyota, but it would be a happier place still MP, if we weren't still, even with those times, in a position where we were predicting something like a 2-lap advantage at the end of 24 hours to the Toyotas, if everything is equal. But it is those final words in that statement, isn't it? If everything remains equal, if everything remains, you know, solid and reliable, then Toyota will come home with an advantage. The reality is that's not going to happen. I had a long chat with Alistair Moffat, the fabulous PR the Toyota Gazoo Racing guys, and we were chatting about the record that Toyota have had at Le Mans in the hybrid era. 13 cars entered at Le Mans over the six-year period so far of that campaign. Of those, two, count them, two, have run without problems. That is the kind of odds that you're talking about at this race. Yes, of course, they will be under a little less pressure. There's no other hybrids to chase wheel-to-wheel throughout the race here, they hope. But, you know, even if we ascribe that, you know, that everybody stays reliable, it's a figure from Paul Truswell, none less, from Radio Le Mans, saying that he expects it to be something like a two-lap advantage. That's about 7 minutes. You don't have to have too big a problem to lose 7 minutes. Let's wait and see. I'm going to go into this with eyes wide open and watching really hard. And I'll say again what I think I said last week here, MP, which is, yes, at the moment, it looks like it's Toyota's race to lose. They've lost it before. And if it does prove to be Toyota's race to lose, and they are heading off into the distance, there's going to be one hell of a lot of racing behind, not least in that GT class. I think once we get to race week, whatever happens with BOP, we're going to be racing, I think, in far closer contention in terms of those lap times across the 17-car GTE Pro field. That could be an all-time great class battle, and I intend to relish every single second of it.
Mention one final thing here on BOP, and I think this is our first, or this is our second use. I'm not sure, but we got to maintain our strict policy of no more than three per episode. If having covered the prototype side, Graham, I am definitely looking at GTE Pro and wondering how solid of a job Ford did in running. Effectively P3, 4, 5, and 6 in class during the test. Close, but still approximately half a second off, more like 4/10 off from the Porsches and such. But just curious how good of a job they did in that wonky, weird place of, hey, we know you're going to do something balance-wise before we get to the race. We don't want to assert ourselves too heavily, but we also don't want to run so far off the pace that we are actually taking away from our ability to learn and capture proper data for ourselves, right? It's the one thing to try and not show everything and hopefully be not quite fast enough in the conversation, but enough to speak to the organizers and say, you know, look, you can see we're not bad, but boy, if you could just give us a little something, we'd be right there. And then you have, you know, in the case of some other cars where you look at maybe the fastest of the Corvettes, a 354.17 compared to the 352.5, you know, nigh on 2 seconds off. I know the Corvette folks would not try and intentionally run that slow because that is far enough off to where, you know, if that is the data that you're gathering and the best you can do is almost 2 seconds off, you are not actually arming yourselves with a lot of great information going into the race about what the car needs to perform at a higher ceiling. So, again, for me, I always look at this stuff not just in the numbers that have been put up, but how close they are or are not to the outright leaders and whether those numbers might either pique the interests of those setting the balance of performance tables or whether you are, you know, far enough off where it's just a clear, guys, look, we're dead in the water. You may as well classify us in GTE AM at this pace because we're barely ahead of those cars. So just an interesting thing to see what the ACO, NFIA, WEC will decide of who gets the good favor, who gets the bad favor as we head into practice next week.
Well, I'd say this much before we get into the next kind of part of it, MP, which is it's irritating enough now that if this is game playing by a number of the teams, I had one senior factory representative approach me and say, look, you know, we talked to all of the factories. We said, look, it's time. If we've got this outside of Le Mans, this auto BOP, that we're in a different place with this. Let's all run at full tilt. No game playing. Ford said, yes, Porsche were the people apparently that suggested this. They were running pretty well. If that's true, and I'm sure that's just as much game playing as well, then there's a lot of game playing going on. Maybe it's time that they got a lesson. And maybe it's time that actually what they were told is, okay, let's run without BOP. Let's see how you like that for a race or two. Because sure as eggs is eggs, one or two of those cars without BOP will not be competitive. I think it's time for a different approach. It's time for no more Mr. Nice Rulemaker. Because, you know what? You try to do your level best to unpick what's going on with these things. It's time that this process was an awful lot more open. Because if this is going to be what we look forward to for the rest of the modern era of GT racing, then the game plan needs to be called out and BOP needs to be an awful lot more open. Because, to be honest with you, it's getting pretty boring. It's getting pretty boring that we don't really know what people have got because people are too busy game playing themselves, as well as the rule makers, as well as all of the other teams. What they seem to be forgetting is that it's not very respectful for the fans.
Amen. Preach on, Brother Goodwin. Graham, should we also tell folks who might not have seen it on social media that we have a fun new The Week in Sports Cars podcast cartoon logo episode something for us that kind of represents you looking dutifully busy and me looking thoroughly clueless as always?
What, you're the one with the beard in that? Oh, all right. No, it is fantastic. Fabulous stuff by your good friend, Mr. Warwick. I have to tell you that when my good lady actually saw it for the first time, it took her a good 2 or 3 minutes to stop laughing. So, yeah, that's met the Trudy seal of approval. Yes, absolutely brilliant. Great stuff. A new corporate image.
Yeah, well, I just ordered some stickers, so we will have, I think those are going to be showing up here late next week, so not in time for Le Mans, unfortunately, but we'll have some afterwards, and again, as I find some time, I'll try and get a small batch of t-shirts printed up, so at least you and me and the Daily Sports Car team and whatever other good folks that want one can, I guess, walk around in bad taste with our caricatures being represented on their back. Definitely not on their front. That would scare people.
No, no.
Let's move over to IMSA at Detroit and then dive into a bunch of awesome questions. We talk about playing the game. Man, that to me, Graham, that is what Detroit was in playing the game perfectly for both class winners. Action Express Racing taking the overall victory in their Cadillac DPI VR with Felipe Nasr and 2016 IMSA prototype champ Eric Curran behind the wheel. Based on, all right, third use, good Lord, I apologize. Based on recent BOP developments, we saw that the Cadillacs were nowhere at the previous round in mid-Ohio, and there was a little bit of pace here or there at Detroit leading into the race, but there really was nothing to suggest that the V8-powered cars with their global headquarters located just, you know, genuinely casting a shadow on the track almost so close. There's really nothing to suggest, Graham, that we were going to go into Saturday's race with the Cadillacs having anything more than maybe a sniff of third place, maybe fourth. The Team Penske Acuras were incredibly strong. We had a pole position taken, mercurial pole position taken by Pipo Durrani in his Tequila Patron ESM Nissan, another surprise. But really, the Cadillacs did not look like they were going to factor. And wow, amazing, amazing strategy by the Action Express team. One of the things they're known for, definitely one of their strong points. Not only the pace of Felipe Nasr, but also the point in time where they chose to do their pit stop and just honestly turned the tables on what looked like it was going to become another Acura 1-2. I mean, coming off of Acura leading every session at Mid-Ohio, finishing 1-2 to get their breakthrough win, honestly, mate, I was tempted to start writing the race report about halfway through the event and just, you know, Acura takes second 1-2 finish. And our friends at Action Express Racing, again, with crafty pit strategy, jumped them faster pit stops as well. One thing that really stood out as curious was with the time, point in time, where the Acuras made their final pit stop, it looked like they did not need every drop of fuel to get to the finish, and yet it definitely appeared like rather than doing a timed stop and only fueling as much as they needed to get to the finish, it looks like they kept both cars on pit lane until the tanks were all the way topped up. And again, at least looking from the outside in, it appeared like that was a difference between winning and losing, because that extra second or two sitting on pit lane stationary was really all that Nasr needed to flip the proverbial script, take the lead, and march home to his first IMSA win. So that, I thought, was just, I love stuff like that, mate. We have races where we have amazing cars, just knockdown, drag-out fight based on pure speed. I really love it when we mix things up and we have smarts come into play and we have the folks on the timing stand who go, I wonder if this might do it. And in this case, it absolutely did. So good on Action Express for not only winning for General Motors and Cadillac at their home race, but also in light of the pace car crash that took place on Sunday with Mark Royce, a VP there at GM, and one of the Corvette ZR1s. There was a lot of publicity coming out of the event. It was probably more centered on Royce crashing that car, unfortunately, but it's good to see that they did indeed leave with a win, courtesy of the Action Express team. The other thing, too, Graham, that I loved was watching what took place in GT Daytona. We did have back-to-back wins for Meyer Shank Racing with their Acuras, not consecutive in 2018, but they won this race last year with Catherine Legg behind the wheel and her then-teammate Andy Lally, with Mario Farnbacher stepping in, deputizing with Alvaro Parent being busy for the weekend. Cat and young Mr. Farnbacher did an amazing job. Similar strategy-aided win. But I would say what was a little bit different here, Graham, is the raggedness involved in turning the tables on the pole-sitting Paul Miller Racing Lamborghini driven by Madison Snow and Brian Sellers. There was definitely advantage gained in the pits, but before we got to that stage, where that advantage then helped the MSR Acuras to succeed and come in 1-2, we had crazy battles going on between Brian Sellers and Catherine Legg, and I would say that I have seen Graham Catherine put in some very impressive drives throughout her career. I don't know if I have seen one as impressive as her just dogged pursuit of Sellers during her stint in that car. So knowing that hard work behind the wheel was then rewarded with a victory that also included the folks on pit lane factoring in, I just thought that this was a pretty cool result for them. And yeah, on the other end of the Acura spectrum, I think, as I mentioned, they might have thought that they were going to sweep the event with a win in prototype overall and in GTD. Obviously, Cadillac outclassed everyone for the overall, but cool to see that Acura still had a very strong statement to make in GT Daytona.
Isn't it a pleasure? This is not the first time since our, well, relatively recent adoption of this this podcast format, MP, that we can talk without making that big a deal of it about a female driver taking a significant race win. And it's just becoming part and parcel with drivers like Catherine, with drivers like Fleck Hagen, the British GT Championship, Christina Nielsen. It just does your heart good to see things moving forward for one reason and one reason only, because these girls are really quick. And, you know, going head to head here with some of the best in the business. Great stuff.
I also appreciated watching Catherine coming over turn two, which is the crest where cars can get light, lift a wheel or two. It's also where Mark Roy spun and crashed the pace car. There were more than a few points captured during the broadcast, Graham, where Kat, in pursuit of the Lamborghini, at least three wheels off the ground, if not four. She was going full Nordschleife in Belle Isle in Detroit. So, again, just, yeah, a lot of fun to watch. And when you have some hardcore racing going down and, you know, a team coming out on top after not only losing pole, but also looking like that Lamborghini might have had a little bit of extra pace. That was just truly a joy to watch. All right. Anything else come to mind recent event-wise for us to discuss before we get into questions? Oh, we got one, questions.
Yeah, I mean, one to keep an eye on, and that is the glorious news that next on the agenda for the hashtag 919 tribute is the Nordschleife. And it's Timo Bernard that appears to be on duty for this one. Keep an eye on that, because that could be pretty spectacular. I think if that thing gets a good run at it, it's going to absolutely obliterate anybody else's mark set there. There's some trackside video kicking around, including by a couple of DSC readers. That's one to keep an eye out. Our very favourite, literally pointless endeavour from the Porsche boys and girls.
You know, it was such a delightful thing that that, along with some other, I guess you could almost say, pointless endeavors by other manufacturers and teams throughout the years, was a feature piece that was commissioned that I happened to pen that will be in the next issue of Racer Magazine. So thanks to Porsche for having good ideas pop into the brains of folks like myself and Racer's Lawrence Foster. All right, where should we start with our questions? Oh, you got questions. Should we start Twitter, where we actually have quite a few questions this week, more than usual?
Well, I'm looking at Facebook. You go for Twitter, and I'll keep an eye on Facebook, because there's one heck of a lot of questions this week. What we might do is, if we spot one or two that are more pertinent for next week's show, put them just an aside there for next week, because what is it, 40 plus?
Yeah. We're at about looking at adding in. Oh, mate, we. Oh, okay. I'm still scrolling here. My guess is 50 to 60 questions with wow. Twitter and Facebook combined, and we have 51 minutes left to go, just because I have an interview with Ford performance boss Mark Rushbrook in 52 wow. minutes. So, yeah, I think you just nailed it. We're going to do our best to get to all the questions that come in next week for our Le Mans preview show. We should probably try and cap it at about 2 hours, mate, but that might be silly. But
yep, that's what.
I think some of these are definitely going to get rolled over to next week. But all right, well, let me find one here to kick off with Twitter questiones. Here we go. Tim Stoll, Jackie Chan DC Racing, almost won the Le Mans 24-hour last year with a clearly dominant Oreca chassis. Why would they switch to a clearly inferior Ligier chassis? Thanks for your time. Love the show.
They haven't. They've got both. They've got the two Oreca chassis, which are their regular WEC cars, numbers 37 and 38.
Yep.
In addition to that, they earned additional places at Le Mans through other performances, including that win at Le Mans that entitles them to an auto entry, plus auto entries for the LMP2 and LMP3 class wins in the Asian Le Mans series. So in theory, they could have had up to five, given the opportunity for the additional two. With slight controversy, we're allowed to put those entries, albeit with their team name, effectively in the hands of Onroke, because those cars are being run by Onroke. So we've got one effectively AM car, with David Cheng, with Nick Boulay from the world of IMSA and Pierre Nicolet. He of being the son of Jacques Nicolet. And in fact, Pierre looks after the US end yep. of the on-rogue empire, including Crawford. And then you've got the Pro car, which is the car that features Ricky Taylor as the star in that car, with David Heimer Hansen and Com Ledegaard. So they've got four cars here, two Oricas, two Ligiers, but two very, very different teams. And in fact, are nowhere close to being next door to each other in the pit lane either. So they've stuck with their Oricas. And the Ligier thing will be a one-shot deal or a two-shot deal because there's two of them.
But to your point, Tim, obviously there are four entries on the list, two of them being Orecas, two of them being Ligiers. The fastest of the kind of special, hey, Onro, could you help us with the extra entries that we've earned and to staff those accordingly, the fastest of the Ligiers, the Jackie Chan GC Racing Ligiers, is 2.5 seconds slower than the fastest of their Oreca 07. So, yeah, as you mentioned, different objectives here, but it is what it is, and I'm just going to keep using Juan Montoya's favorite line here because it's so glorious. It says everything and nothing at the same time. Let's see. I'm going to go for
Brandon Yarmark. Why do organizations like IMSA, there aren't any organizations like IMSA, go out of their way to spend money and develop third-party apps and streaming services from the ground up when YouTube is available for live streaming? YouTube is accessible on so many more platforms, a built-in app on most smart TVs, which would make cord cutters happy. There is an answer here, which is control and commercial interest, because if you've got an app, you've got control of both the service and indeed the data. Putting together an app means that you have the rights to your own product. You're not beholden to a third-party service. Completely get it in terms of the reach, but there are two points at play here. Number one is getting all the information you can from the customers that you manage to bring to your service. Number two is that you keep control of the product, you keep control of any commercialization of it. It's not an answer that everybody's happy with, but it's the answer.
And you also have the ability to then charge either advertisers or manufacturers to have Indeed. A presence in that app as well. So, well, let's stick with this dynamic. You choose from the Facebook questions you like, Monsieur yep. Goodwin, and I will stick over here on my little Twitter island. Let's see. Oh, we had someone send this in last night, which was great. As I mentioned in our request for questions, blah, blah, blah. If you have questions for Graham Goodwin and I, and someone responded, that should read for Graham Goodwin and me, not I. No, it shouldn't. Let's see. All right. Well, actually, Andy Napier from Andy Napier Racing sent in a question via direct message, which I don't suggest because I start to lose track of 15 different places where things come in. I did cut and paste that into Facebook, so please get to that. But Andy wanted to check and make sure we got it. Yes, we did.
Yep, I'm reading it now.
Okay, but let me grab here. All right, here we go. Right Turn Lover, who often sends in great questions. Why could the IMSA cars double stint tires in Detroit when the Indy cars are struggling with tire life? And what do you think the nationality of the LM24 pole sitter will be? Well, that's a great question. The first one, I would say we have very different objectives here. With endurance racing, even though this was a 100-minute race, doesn't mean that Continental made 100-minute tires. It means that the same tires that are meant to last double, triple, however many stints at other rounds were the same ones employed, or same mindset and style brought to Detroit or Long Beach. So as a result, if you were to walk up and try and dig your thumbnail into those tires, wouldn't get very far. You walk over to Firestone, which is the exclusive provider for the IndyCar series, and they have a completely different objective. While they are spec, while they're the only supplier, they are indeed trying to make as much performance as possible within, I guess, a reasonable budget point, you stick your thumb into those tires and it goes in a lot farther because they're gummier, they're softer. So just two totally different approaches here with the IMSA cars, even though it was a, you know, call it a sprint race. Actually, I think the race was actually shorter than the IndyCar race. The IndyCar races, the Continentals are meant to last. The Firestones are meant to last much less amount of time. And so that is simply that. As for the nationality of the LM24 pole sitter,
Swiss.
Well, maybe, but I don't know who they're going to put in the cars for qualifying yet. So, we could kind of go through the leading cars and say who we think would be on pole if they were tasked with such a thing. I mean, Swiss isn't a bad idea.
I don't think you should assume it's going to be Toyota.
You know, interesting. I don't know.
Go ahead. The one thing I'd say, MP, is that of the measures that have been taken around the LMP1 non-hybrids, not very much or many of them, in terms of both the number of and the scope of changes, have restricted their ability to go fast. It's restricting their ability to go further, but we know already that the ability of the Toyota to go quicker than we've seen at the test day is there and proven. I don't think we should assume that the Rebellion, for instance, hasn't got something in reserve. Remember, the difference here is that is a 700 horsepower all the time car.
Yep.
325 last year for the LMP2 pole sitter with a broadly similar, if you like, and it's a wrong phrase, but I'll use it because it's an easy one to use, dumbed down package, smaller Gibson engine, less sophisticated aero, heavier. We've already seen the car do a 319. Is there much more in the bank? And by the way, who's to say that Toyota are going to get free run as they did? It was a lucky free empty lap for Kamui Kobayashi. That doesn't happen very often. Who knows what can happen with a little bit of weather? Don't assume it's going to be a Toyota pole position. It should be. It probably will be, but I'm not making that assumption. And I think there's one or two people out there, Messrs. Lotterer and Yani, for instance, who would like to go out there and mess with them a little bit.
All right, brother. Pick one from the Book of Faces.
Let's go for Andy Napier's question. You're gifted the power to grant immortality to one living sports car driver purely for your own selfish ends. This could be motivated by desire to continue to watch their driving style, which would transcend the bounds of time henceforth, or possibly just that they do the funniest tweets. The choice and selfish reasoning behind them.
You want me to go first?
You can go for that.
So, immortality. Do we think that limits us, Graham, to those who are still alive? Or would that maybe...
It does say to one living sports car driver.
Okay, all right, fair enough. I would say Hans Stuck.
Ooh, good call.
Having seen him... by the time I would had seen him in person, you know, his Formula One days had gone by, but having seen him in Porsche 962s, having seen him in Audi Trans Am and IMSA cars, and seen him in a variety of other things, possibly the most entertaining sports car driver I've witnessed, and just in terms of career span, behind the wheel, driving style. I don't know if I've mentioned it here before. I know I've mentioned it before in other podcasts. He was one of my father's favorite drivers, and the thing he always said lovingly about Stuck was he always knew which car was his when he went by because there were more bugs on the side of the car than on the windshield because, you know, he was just seemingly in a lifelong power slide. You throw in the yodeling, you throw in just the fact that he's such a warm and bubbly, dynamic personality as well. If I could have Hans Stuck forever in perpetuity, I think the world would be just a heck of a lot better.
you know what? You're on the same lines as me. I mean, the two names that immediately sprung to mind, one of whom isn't known as a sports car racer, but he's done the odd race or several, Walter Röhrl, because I just happen to think he's probably the best driver that ever lived. Mm. But beyond that, it's the similar idea, but with a kind of slightly different bent, and it's Derek Bell. And Derek, I think, is just the most gentle soul, just the most lovely individual that the planet just needs him to survive. It's as simple as that. I'll give you a great little story about Dinger from just a week or so ago. Did a wing walk on a biplane a couple of weeks ago for charity, and God knows how old Derek is now. But enjoyed it so much, did it twice. It's not that low, MP. That's impressive enough. The charity effort didn't really take off, if you'll pardon the pun. My good friend and colleague, Stephen Kilby, gave me a ring and said, do you mind if I actually put something up on Daily Sports Car to give it a bit of a boost? Of course not. Dropped Derek a line. And about half a day later, I got this excitable call from the young Mr. Kilby saying, you're not going to believe this, Gigi. Derek Bell just called me and he knows who I am.
Oh.
And that's just, you know what? That sounds ridiculous, but I know exactly how that makes you feel. I know exactly how that makes you feel. He is a legend. He is one of my sporting heroes. And I said before on the show, I come from a kind of mindset that it gives me just that kind of butterfly in the stomach every single time I realize that Jan Lammers knows who I am. Mm. I just it's that kind of thing. It's that teenager back in the room again. And yeah, Derek Bell, I just think, is a fantastic individual.
I count my blessings just about every day with this new career of mine. New, of course, it started in 2006, but it still feels new. And the ability, the fact that I can say Derek Bell has become a friend is just, it's mind-boggling, because he is absolute hero, you know, hero worship. But he and I are going to record a podcast next week, building off of a conversation we had about a week ago on just the rigors and the differences of racing at Le Mans during the two driver era, for example, and just during a time where no air conditioning, lots of heat. Just what was it like back in the day without the creature comforts? And you know, we've already, you know, had a lot of that conversation. It just wasn't recorded, but fascinating to listen to. And we're also going to talk about some of his favorite Porsche races in honor of the new book that has come out about all of his Porsche races. So yeah, just good Lord, a dear, dear man. Also, just mentioning this for whatever reason, if I haven't already, it's fallen out of my brain if I did, but just before we started recording here, spent about 40 minutes on the phone with dear Andy Wallace to capture a podcast, yes, on the 30th anniversary of what we call Jaguar, which you would call Jaguars, victory at Lasarth in 1988. So meant to speak with Tony Dow about that from the team side, but great stuff from Andy about that. That'll be in podcast form. And if I get a hold of good old Jan Lammers, I sent him a text, just haven't heard back, then we'll hopefully have three different voices calling back to 1988. So all kinds of fun.
Well, we'll have a bit of a special around Jan. In fact, literally while I've been recording this, push the button on the first of what should be five. Just a bit of a look back at some of the anniversaries, the special moments this year. One of which is to do with this will be, next week, will be Jan Lammers' 24th Le Mans 24 Hours. And with the help of our good friend John Brooks and his fantastic archive. Looking back at some... Oh yeah, yeah. Bad Santa. Looking back at each of Jan's previous Le Mans 24 Hours, we've got a few other treats in store.
Brilliant.
It's a beautiful 1998 album just been published on Daily Sports Car of images from the 1998 race week. But Jan, just an ace guy, just absolutely excellent. Your turn.
Even though he's Dutch, I mean, you know, there are miracles in the world.
They're terrible people.
Oh, good Lord! You know, all right, I might throw in a couple here from Twitter because we've got a few that are relatively short. We'll see if our answers are short. Joel Nahn says, "Which Porsche throwback livery do you like more, Pink Pig or Rothmans?" Joel, I have to admit, I like both. I'm happy that Porsche has done both. I'm probably the millionth sports car fan to have said, boy, I really wish they would have done those while they were still running the P1 hybrids, because when I think Pink Pig, I don't think of a GT car. And I guess on the Rothman side, you know, we could maybe say Paris Dakar, Porsche 959. I mean, there were some GT-ish cars, whether they were full factory or not, that wore that cigarette brand's logo, or livery, I should say. But at least for me, my mind says, that looks awesome, but the canvas is a little bit off. I would say just in terms of execution, the Pink Pig version of the 911 RSR stands out to me as being a little more crisp. The Rothmans, I think, has just gotten lost. Some of the lines that would flow on a prototype don't necessarily flow on this GT silhouette shape. So I would go with Pink Pig, but yeah, if we're borrowing from a 917, I think it should be on a 919, not a 911. So that's my little take there. Graham, let's move to Tom Reynolds, who says, thoughts on Toro Rosso, Formula One team, trying to replace Brendan Hartley. And I've read that they were unsuccessful in trying to borrow McLaren's Lando Norris to fill in for the Kiwi. Got to admit, tell me if you agree. I was happy to see Brendan signed to get this opportunity. We know that it came at the expense of the Chip Ganassi Racing IndyCar deal that he had. Would have joined countryman Scott Dixon in the team this year. That deal was undone by Toro Rosso. Brendan has not measured up as, I guess, many have hoped. I'm wondering, do you think he's actually done himself some harm here? Because if his Formula One opportunity goes away, there aren't many factory prototype drives available. And would an IndyCar team want someone who left IndyCar for an opportunity and then got bounced out for not being fast enough?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? It is a very hard world indeed at that kind of level. And, you know, you're allowed bad luck, but how many times are you allowed bad luck? I mean, bear in mind, it's not just Brendan Hartley who's been talked about in this way. It is Max Verstappen as well, who's been talked about in very much the same way that the clock is now ticking on the man that was seen as being the new Messiah just a few weeks ago. I think he'll get a shot. We know he's quick. We know that part of this has been bad luck. Whether or not he'll get quite as good a shot as he would have had before taking this one, I think is a different matter. How much longer has he got before the door closes on this one? Well, let's wait and see. I don't like to write people's career obituaries before either they or their employers do. But, you know, for me, it's looked very much like, you know, on the back foot. Is there a degree of kind of, you know, inner panic that involves itself and, you know, gets to the point where you do overdrive, you are more prone to mistakes? I think the answer is that yes, there is. That being the case, I don't think I particularly want Brendan, who I do regard as a mate, to be taking those kind of risks on an Indy Oval anytime soon. I'd like to see him in something that shows off his absolutely blinding natural speed and talent. But, you know, I don't think that necessarily means that he needs to find a replacement gig for a gig he hasn't lost yet this week.
Fair point. All right, mate. What's next on Facebook?
What have we got there? It's a useless question from Matt Wolf. Thanks, Matt. Might be one for you. Useless question. Wondering what happened to the inflatable Corvette Thunderdome? Haven't seen it in any paddock this year.
Yeah, that's a great question. Not useless. I had it. It did fall into my brain. I think it's Sebring. Wondering why the bouncy castle was not there.
And I'd heard it was used for Danny Binks's birthday party, and it went horribly wrong.
He left a screwdriver in his pocket and popped the Dan, bad Dan, bad. I don't know. I will try and remember to ask, which is kind of saying I'm going to fail in that endeavor. But if I'm just throwing pure assumptions without any knowledge from speaking with the team, I do know that I heard a couple teams saying, boy, they sure do get a lot of paddock space. That's more than us. Why do they get to take up so much? I don't know if that was something that, you know, IMSA, quote, cracked down on, or maybe it'll resurface somewhere else. I can't say. But if I remember, I will try and ask and find out.
I have heard another rumor, by the way. I'd heard it's got a big, soft, padded sides, loads of room. It's so that the management can park their cars without damage.
Ooh. Hey, try the veal, boys and girls. Oh, Lord. I thought you were going to say, since it's large and padded, it was perfect for all the nutters that work for the team and also drive cars. So, let's see. Let me find something here on... All right, on the tweeters, endurancengt.co.uk asks...
Would be Andy. That would be Andy.
And thanks for excluding me from my own podcast here, Andy. Whatever. All kidding aside, I'd be interested to know Graham's thoughts on the pace of the Ginetta LMP1s. Do we expect them to be closer to the front by qualifying? And again, if we're just using pure numbers to base responses on the Ginetta G60 LT P1 Mechachrome, the fastest was 11th at the test day. 8.6 seconds arrears from the Toyota Gazoo Racing at number 8.
Right, okay. Happy to answer the question. First and foremost, we're running with high downforce bodywork at the test day. The low downforce bodywork, I am told, will be ready for race week. Whether or not they're allowed to use it, whether or not they're allowed to use it, having not used it at test day, I simply don't know. Two is... Make no mistake here, they're on the back foot, having lost much of their test program to the financial woes of their principal customer for the car, but fighting back. Did have some problems for one of the cars in the first session of test day. The sixth car lost a turbo, but once those cars started running, what we were seeing was steady improvements up the field. It was two later laps from the two quickest P2 cars that put them off the bottom of the train of LMP1s, and actually only a late improvement from Renger van der Zander in the Dragon Speed car that actually beat those times. So what they're going to be chasing is reliability, and they're going to be chasing it because it's going to be one hell of a 24 hours for the Manor guys, the TRSM team, and the Ginetta guys that are there helping them in numbers for this one. Am I surprised at the lack of pace? No, I'm not, because that's what you get from a test program. Do I think we'll see improvements? I think if they can get sustained running through free practice and qualifying. Remember, qualifying at Le Mans is a long old deal. It's hours and hours on track. I think there are things that can be found. They did look, I have to say, very tired and very ragged. I think they'll be looking forward to a few down days between test day and race week to regather themselves and think of some of the simple answers to those difficult questions. But I think we'll see improvements. Lawrence Tomlinson from Ginetta talking about looking for a buyer for the third car. There are three cars available. There is a full spare chassis with spares package. If they come out unscathed, there will be a third car available for the Silverstone race if a customer emerges. And I am beginning to hear that there is interest for the LMP1 grid to expand, which is very good news indeed. So let's wait and see what comes forward from that. And by expand, I don't mean wait until the next season. I mean during this season. So let's wait and see. for the moment, I'd go this far. Do I think they're going to win? No. Do I think they're going to finish? I hope so, but I think that's going to be their battle. But I absolutely wish them well. Really trying hard to make this happen in a way that would do them and their companies proud. And you've got to love that in a team.
Okay, so what Graham was wanting to say but didn't, because he is a good son of the United Kingdom and wants to support Janetta as much as possible, is no, he doesn't think they're going to finish. Not because he's a bad man, but because reality says when you come to the party this late, that's the expected outcome.
So. It's 24 hours of pure hell, yes. I think is what it comes down to. If they finish that race, that will be an enormous result. Enormous result. Let's not forget some of the major factory efforts that have tried and failed, including Aston Martin with the AMR1, including, you know, obviously Nissan with the GTR LM, and there are others too, including BMW when they came first with a prototype, including, of course, infamously Mercedes-Benz with the CLR. Everybody pointing fingers and saying, oh, you know, that's not very good, blah, blah. Remember, massive, massive efforts that just didn't work when push came to shove. You've got to, I think, appreciate the efforts of the of people like this, and they won't be the only ones who have a difficult weekend, I'm sure of that. Got to appreciate the efforts and get behind the effort rather than picking fault here and there. The reality is, this program has not gone the way that anybody involved would have wanted it to, but they're not giving up, and I think that's great.
And how strange is it that 5 months in, we found out that Graham's inner voice is both American and Californian. So, okay, all right, here we are, back to the old podcast. All right, Mr. Goodwin, we have approximately 23 minutes left. I believe our Dutch-Nigerian chocolatier has a question on Facebook that we need to get to shortly. But we've got a couple here on Facebook that are fitting. One, just some great straight-up questions. And we also have at least one or two that are the fun kind of bend-your-mind silly stuff. Let's start with Andrew Pike. He says, in LMP1, we have different refueling times, stint lengths between Toyota and the others, but could we see a minor or potential vastly different ability to multi-stint tires? Quad stinting has been possible in the past. Do you think the privateers could manage this? Yeah,
it's not going to make any difference. It's not going to make much difference.
Well, Andrew, I would just throw this in. Beyond BOP, EOT, beyond any of those items, beyond the fact that we have a Toyota TS050 hybrid that has quadrillions of dollars poured into it, I would say the biggest thing to take home is while essentially the entire, well, I guess not just essentially, but unless I'm missing one, I believe the entire LMP1 grid, hybrid, non-hybrid, is running on Michelins. That's wonderful.
Correct.
So that's a positive thing for sure. We know the quality of Michelins. And granted, if some were on Dunlop, we would know that those are high quality as well. I would say the big thing we're just talking about here in stint length, sure, some could try to go, you know, obscenely long on a set of tires, but keep in mind that beyond some of the other things we might think about or reasoning, maybe beyond the Rebellion team, I can't think of any non-hybrid entrant that could say they feel comfortable, like they have a proper grasp of what their cars could do balance-wise over getting into a third stint and even a fourth stint. So it's not a question of can we plan and then run, again, multiple stints on a set of tires. It's do they have the aero mapping knowledge? Do they have the full confidence in the mechanical setup on the cars to know that the tires will last? Not last as in not blow up, but just actually provide a performance benefit. So again, if we're just talking determining stint length, Graham, the fact that so many of the non-hybrid P1 cars are just short on mileage, short on knowledge, coming back next year, I'd say yes, absolutely. If folks wanted to go, you know, as long as possible, they would certainly have the knowledge to do that and have peace of mind in doing it. This year, I can't find many that would say that.
It's a short stint length, of course, for the little hybrid, something like about 37 minutes, I think, we're expecting. So around a little less, in fact, the time that the P2 cars will be running. The difference this year, it's another big difference that's, you know, really the impact is beginning to make itself known, is there will be no time advantage in the pits to do that, because as of this year in the WEC, which includes the Le Mans 24 Hours, the pit stop rules have changed so that you fuel and change tyres at the same time.
Yep.
So there's no time advantage in the pits anymore for that. And I have heard a couple of cynical comments suggesting that perhaps this was one of the reasons why this change was made, that it's another area that reduces the potential for a non-hybrid car to forge some kind of advantage. Yes, they're restricted in the number of tyres they can use in the race, but in terms of the time in the pits, there should, with a well-drilled team, be absolutely no advantage whatsoever from changing tyres or not.
And also keep in mind that not every pit stop, which is maybe the heart of what I was getting after, not every pit stop, most, but not every pit stop is done at the true end of the fuel cell's ability to keep the motor alive. You know, some pit stops, based on whether it could be yellows, caution periods, tire degrading, driver needs. I mean, there's a variety of reasons where a car might not go to the last possible second until pitting. So there are instances where putting less fuel in the tank, I'm not talking a huge amount, but where putting less fuel in the tank will happen during pit stops. And in those are the times where you have to say, all right, what are we going to do here that's going to be most advantageous? Could holding on to a set of tires for an additional stint be the thing that actually is more rewarding, because if we're going to actually finish fuel before we would get tires done, again, this is a race 100% about finding track position. This is a race more than anything, despite how fast each car happens to be. Track position is the one thing you cannot surrender, because with the way the yellows work, you pretty much never get it back. We don't have the American style yellow flag, all the cars pack up behind one pace car and off you go again. So that'll be the only area, Graham, where I can really see if a team is, you know, deciding to try and go a little bit longer on a set of tires. Would be that question of how long is fuel going to take versus how long will it take to put new tires on the old hot rod. All right.
We've got we're going to do the Le Mans questions next week. One here for, I think, for you, actually, MP, from David Zitterbarts, another regular. Hello, David. Approaching the halfway point of the IMSA season, what's going on at WTR? Fallen from Cadillac leadership domination to the midfield. Is it more than just a teething issue with getting Renger van der Zander and Jordan compatible on setups? And what's up at Wright Motorsports? Had high expectations of Christina and Pat Long. Results have been ordinary. Weird seeing these two so far down the order.
Yeah, it's the good old WTF, WTR. Well, you have to look at how the season has played out and how it has certainly defied expectations in terms of the team getting to victory lane. I thought after five rounds we would have seen at least one trip. What I think we're seeing most of all, David, is the impact of losing Ricky Taylor. The team has been stable throughout the rest of its championship winning program, barring the move from Ricky to Acura Team Penske and the importation of Renger van der Zande. I do not think that Renger is a downgrade by any stretch of the imagination, but I do believe firmly that the amount of importance Ricky carried in that team, more than just turning the steering wheel and tapping on the pedals, his work setup wise, I think that is the area that we continue to see WTR being not just out of victory lane, but often chasing the Action Express team, which last year they didn't do a lot of that. They were clearly ahead. And this year, I mean, we're looking at two wins so far by the number 5 Action Express team and one win coming last weekend by the sister number 31 entry. So of the five races, we have three that have gone to Cadillac, all three of those from the same team, AXR, not WTR. And if we look at how sharp Acura Team Penske has been, they claim that win at Mid-Ohio, Ricky Taylor, Elio Castroneves. We can certainly say that Ricky's value as a rocket behind the wheel, but also chassis setup-wise, that's been a big part in Acura's immediate success as well. So I think you're on to the heart of things, David. The fact that, you know, Renger is new to the team, the fact that Jordan has readily admitted over the years that he more or less let his brother do the chassis setup side and he lived with whatever it was and made the most out of it. You're now having to go back to the drawing board, Graham, and rely on either Renger, who I believe can have a valuable input, but is having to really work into that role, right? It's a veteran team. New guy coming in, getting the biggest shot of his career, isn't exactly just going to kick the door open and say, all right, this is how it's going to be. I want these springs and this ride height. So, excuse me. I think that's what we're seeing. We're also seeing, again, the inverse of this Brother Taylor's dynamic, I believe, where not only has Ricky been a huge portion of the setup puzzle and making it go fast, but in his absence and with Jordan not having to be that guy, I think that's actually part of what's limiting their ascension in this new tandem of Renger and Jordan. So I don't know if we're going to get to the end of the season without Wayne Taylor Racing winning, but I do know that if we're talking about opportunities, it's not a whole ton of, you know, we're not winding things down, but we're staring at that downhill slide where, you know, between Watkins Glen, Mosport, Road America, Laguna Seca, and Road Atlanta, you know, there's some more chances, but it's not going to be easy. And I have completely forgotten the second question.
Don't worry about that for the moment, because we can shift effortlessly using Adam Smith's question from a question about a European guy going into the States to teams from the States coming into Europe. Because Adam's asking, what do the IMSA teams have to go through to prepare their cars for Le Mans? Do they just unload and go? Is there any kind of changes they have to make? Now, oddly enough, I did actually pick up from the Chip Ganassi Ford team the list of changes they have to make to the US-based cars in order to qualify for Le Mans in GTE Pro. Now, the list, looking through, hang on a minute, right, okay. It's quite short. You have to take out the cup holders. the truck nuts have got to go. The big barbecue on the back, that's another thing that's definitely not required on Voyage. Other than that, good to go, really.
I love it. I mean,
the reality is, of course, major changes to set up. Although probably Le Mans, in terms of the way the road course is, MP, is probably closer to most North American circuits than most of our road courses are in Europe. You know, in terms of the kind of surface, it's not billiard table smooth. We've had a lot of resurfacing, but not billiard table smooth by any means. As you were saying a little earlier with Juan Pablo Montoya's response to it. But the reality is we're dealing with homologated cars. There are going to be minor differences. Obviously, lots of external differences in terms of the numbers they've got to run. You guys don't run an IMSA, of course, with the same light system, do you either?
No. We're just different. We're uppity. we're contrarian. That's just who we are. Let's see. Let me try and find one or two to go here. We've got 11 minutes. Let me find one, maybe two on Twitter, and then we will close the rest of the episode off, Graham, with your choices on the book faces. All right, Paul Sharp, loving the Porsche retro liveries and garage setup for Le Mans. Definitely think Ford have missed a trick to do similar. We've seen 100%. Mazda and BMW do retro and IMSA before. What is your favorite throwback livery? And what others would you like to see that haven't been done yet? Great question, Paul.
Can I chuck one in straight away?
Please.
Much as obviously the car wasn't what it should have been, I thought the Nissan throwback livery on the GTR LM was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
The white, blue, red, I thought on that car was absolutely amazing. I just like well-done retro liveries. We've seen a number of them done in the past. But Pink Pig, I think, is a corker, absolute corker. And you've got classic liveries. I happen to think, albeit it's not a throwback livery, the current Golf Porsche in the WEC that's also at Le Mans is gorgeous. Absolutely spot on that car. And of course, by the way, that's another anniversary this year, the 50th anniversary of Golf Oil's first overall win at the Le Mans 24 Hours. And there'll be lots going on with that fantastic look as well. But yeah, I'm a bit of a sucker for that kind of stuff.
Well, you covered the ones that you've loved. I'll throw in what I haven't seen. And I realize that Jag is no longer, you know, we don't, other than the brief foray from the Paul Gentilozzi run Rocket Sports GT2 Jags, what, 7-8 years ago. We haven't seen the Mark at Le Mans since, but I would say that if someone, any manufacturer, any privateer wanted to model something off of the tone-on-tone silk-cut purples, boy, that to me just seems like pure beauty. Waiting to be applied to a modern race car. Again, it doesn't even have to be Mark specific, just someone who realizes those colors were so beautiful. So if someone were to lay that out on a P1 privateer entry, yeah, I'd be rooting for that sucker privately just about every single lap. Let's see. I've got Greg Pickett calling me. All right, I'll have to call Greg back. I haven't spoken to Greg in a long time. Yeah, hey, good man. Right over the hill from me, too. All right.
A quick question from Justin Ford. Has Pastor Maldonado crashed today? Not today. He did crash to finish the test day on Sunday, just a couple of minutes before the end of the session. Not badly, but pushing very hard. I'll say it again. I think he's ace. I think he's a brilliant addition to the WEC. I'm thoroughly looking forward to working with him for the remainder of the year.
Yeah, the Williams team was at fault for that, though. So
absolutely.
Definitely have to blame them. All right, well, why don't you take us home with a couple from Facebook, my friend?
Well, let's go. There's this weird. I should say, by the way, before we go there, you know, I got a lot of heat on social media about the comments I've made about Canadians,
really?
About Bear Attacks trackside. Yeah. Now, look, we've got the likes of John Ferrano in the Road to Le Mans. We've got obviously Paul Dallalana at Le Mans, and where they go, of course, the Bears follow. And we saw that actually in the immediate aftermath. The immediate aftermath. This is who you blame of Pastor Maldonado's red flag incident to finish the test. Message from race control, and you know he's got the cameras, he knows what he's doing. It was caution, bear left. So it was a bear that actually did it for Pastor Maldonado. I blame Paul Dallalana.
And there's also, I just read, Graham, a few moments ago, the United States has placed tariffs on Canadian bears. So Prime Minister Trudeau angry yet again at the country. So yeah, this is just, boy, I'm sorry that our friends in the Great White North are just seemingly in the crosshairs.
Tim Same actually asks, has any team member ever overslept and missed a stint during recorded Le Mans 24 Hours history? It's happened in Delhi sports car team, I can tell you that for nothing. I don't know about drivers, but yeah, you know, you're the ones who are listening. You know who you are, sleeping in the back seat of the DSC bus. Yes, that's happened. Let's have a quick look here. Let's try with first time caller, Shay Adam. Bear Grylls survival question. You're dropped onto a remote island and have to survive with no supplies given one lineup of drivers in the 2018 24 Hours of Le Mans. What team do you choose and why? Those drivers must also be kept alive, so no sacrificing one for food. That's just too complicated.
But, you know, there's
obviously, if you could sacrifice one for food, it would be Montoya, because there's just so much more of it to go around.
Well marbled. And there's a good reason I'm not there as well, because trust me, I'd be feeding the village. But, great question. Okay, well, I am going to go the number 11 SMP Racing, BR Engineering, BR1, AER, piloted by Russia's Vitaly Petrov, countryman Mikhail Aloshin, and the fine member of Great Britain, Jenson Button. Why? Well, keeping them alive, that's an interesting angle. That implies that you or I, myself in this case, would have to be the one keeping them alive. There's a part of me that thinks Russian-backed team with two Russian drivers. I might be the one having to make sure I'm kept alive, first of all. So that maybe this is a really bad choice. But I'm just thinking, knowing the vast resources that they have, Desert Island, I'm thinking that somehow a Russian submarine pulls up. Some sort of large transport carrier flies overhead. There would be something flown in from Mother Russia or piloted in, something that emerged from the sea. There's no way I can think.
Putin on a horse, yes.
Of all the drivers entered in the race, if I'm stranded on a desert island, while I might need to make sure that I don't become the feast, two Russians with really good connections, we're getting home faster than anyone else. So that's my choice.
I've got a choice. And only because it's just a team I'm not that invested in. The number 50 Larborough crew. Erwin Creed, Romano Ricci, Thomas Dagenau.
All right, how the heck did you get here?
Yeah, strap the three of them together and use them as a raft.
You know, I wasn't thinking, and I also failed to mention, you know, Button probably would keep us entertained.
He's a good guy.
If food was somehow found, dropped off, or otherwise, I'm sure he would know how to prepare it beautifully for us. Desert Island Cuisine by Button, I mean, that kind of has a ring to it, so... Yeah, you can float away on yours. I'm just going to rely on a variety of undercurrents of methods to secure at least the two Russians and hope that they would bring me and Button along with them. So, I don't know. I hope we might have adequately answered that from a new contributor, Shay Adam. I wonder if she knows Shaiya Adam, but if not, the two of you should co-mingle on Facebook.
It's good to see some of the ladies actually going back to motorsport, isn't it? Shay Adam, not a name I'm familiar with.
No,
do tune in again. Do, yes.
Yes. Do you have one quick one? Because we've got about 2.5 minutes left.
Lots of people saying, are the Aston Martins really that slow? No. If they are, then there'd be a lot more people down the road from Pro Drive by now. No, they're not that slow. They won't like me for saying it. I'll be taking some flack next week for saying it. But no, they're not that slow, without a shadow of a doubt. I'm looking down this list, and they're all very long and involved.
Well... maybe we will try and carry some over into our listener-driven Le Mans preview next week.
I think we should. I'll be making a good long list of those and looking forward to that show. That could be quite a lot of fun. MP, that's another week done.
It is. I mean, again, we're 5-ish months into this, and we've yet to come to our senses, so let's keep doing it.